This is, I don't really call this a sermon, but at the same time, it's not really just archaeology. This is where these come together in a fabric and a dynamic. When God approaches Abram in Genesis chapter 12, go from your kindred, or from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. And those who bless you, I will bless. And those who curse you, I will curse. And through you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Now, as we look at the entire range of Scripture, we, in retrospect, certainly understand that ultimately the blessing to all humanity is through the birth of Jesus Christ. And Paul points this out very clearly in the book of Galatians. But when we look at the life of Abram and Abraham, and I'm typically going to refer to him as Abraham, so please understand the time frame. And he leaves his homeland. Now there's a two-stage departure that takes place. He begins that foray in the city of Ur, down in the southern part of Mesopotamia. And the highlight physical feature that characterizes the city of Ur is the ziggurat of Ur. The upper picture is its condition before it was cleaned up and restored, and then the bottom one is the one that is after restoration. And you can get some idea of how big it is by looking at that 1956 Buick sitting there in the front. Now, if you don't know how big a 1956 Buick is, that might not communicate as well. This is not a Geo, all right? So this is not one of your little foreign cars. These were massive vehicles. And so you can get an idea of how large this was. And the top part of this is missing. Now, where Abram lives in proximity to this, I really don't know. But it's one of those imposing structures. Now, sadly, I've never seen it. My wife doesn't want me to go there to see it either because of current situations. But I read in the records that this can be seen from like 20 miles away. So essentially, wherever Abram is, he would have been able to see this. And Ur was one of those great sites. It's a metropolis for all practical purposes of the ancient world. And so he's familiar with sort of the sophistication of an urban life. What exactly he did at that point in life, we don't know. Probably fair to infer that he was probably a shepherd, like he's going to continue to be. But he's familiar with this urbanization. And Mesopotamia was part of that cradle of civilization that becomes part of the development of human nature and human civilization. Among the things that he would be familiar with is the idea of law and order. Now, that doesn't mean that people necessarily follow the laws, as we well know. But the Code of Hammurabi, there's a big discussion about whether Abram is contemporary with him or not. And whether you suggest that he is or not is sort of irrelevant, because the idea of law and order was something that existed long before Abram even comes on the scene. We have tablets of law that have been preserved from 2200 BC. And of course, that tends to imply that there were laws earlier than that. Now, none of them are as visually compelling as the Code of Hammurabi. The Code of Hammurabi stands about 7.5 feet tall, and most people can't see the top of it very well. So here's a close-up picture of the top of it that I took at the copy of this in the University of Chicago. And the portrayal here is an interesting one, because it shows Shamash, the god of justice and light. By the way, the word Shamash in the Akkadian language means sun. Okay, it's, the Hebrew counterpart is Shemesh. Some of you have chatted with me and you know that I am field director of the project at Tel Bet Shemesh, house of the sun. So you have the same kind of dynamic that comes into play. But Shamash is the god of light. He's the sun. And if you look at this carefully, on the upper shoulders, you see these little wavy lines. That's the light radiating from him, representing the sun. Okay, and nothing new under the sun, pardon the pun. All right. People draw the picture and have the stuff to raise radiating out. And the people in antiquity had exactly the same kind of thing. And in this, Hammurabi is standing in front of him receiving the law. And so the idea is that the law is of divine origin. Now, I'm not going to argue, and I do not buy into the premise that Moses borrowed from the code of Hammurabi. But God is a God of justice. God is a God who expects and wants people to respect one another. And as you read the code of Hammurabi, it's very clear that the Gentile world had an understanding. And so within parameters, I would argue that God has revealed himself. And Abram is familiar with this. And so as he then is summoned, he eventually leaves Ur of the Chaldees. He goes to Haran with the family. And it is there that he is summoned in Genesis, as recorded in Genesis chapter 12. Leave your country and your kindred and your father's house and go to the land that I will show you. Now, here's where this is going to get a little tedious. So I want you to bear with me, follow through the discussion and so forth. When I was younger, and I have to admit, even up until I was 34 years old, I would read the narrative and think in terms of Abraham's running around down here in the land of Canaan with his sheep and his goats, and this is not a very urbanized area, and so while there are some, if you read the text, of course, there are some encounters with some kings, Melchizedek, for instance. And there are some cities. To a large extent, Abram is just out in the countryside herding his animals. But when I got into the archaeology program at the University of Arizona, the texture of the text becomes much more dramatic. Not that the text is wrong. Don't get me wrong. Don't misunderstand what I'm getting at. The text is not incorrect here. But there's a rich undercurrent that is going on here. And as I began to study this and look at it, it became clear that Abraham is much more an individual of faith than I had earlier understood. And that's sort of what I want to talk about this morning. This evening. I did have a nap. Okay, maybe I miscued. So as he is approached, Ur of the Chaldees is off there in the bottom of the Mesopotamian area, just north of the Persian Gulf. The family goes first to Haran, which is sort of the apex of this triangle. Eventually, that's where the spouses of the son and grandson are going to be secured. And then the Bible, it talks about him going to Shechem, where he sets up an altar and offers a sacrifice to the Lord before he then moves to Ai and Bethel, between Ai and Bethel, and sets up his tent. So this is the range of the travels that we have. And as Abram then arrives in the area, he's eventually going to migrate into the southern part, primarily, of the land of Canaan. Now, it's critically important here to remember that the land of Canaan, as far as the biblical story is concerned, is not very big. From Dan, all of you have heard from Dan to Beersheba. Okay. That's sort of a merism that refers to the entire range of what Israel occupies. It's not the full range. It's sort of like talking about from New York to Los Angeles. Well, what about the folks in San Diego? And what about the folks in Maine? But from New York to Los Angeles is an accommodation of the entire range and doesn't ignore the extensions beyond that. But from Dan to Beersheba is the merism to refer to the entire range of ancient Israel. And the distance here is, hang on to your boots, about 150 miles. This is a tiny, tiny country. And it's very important for us to get that in mind. God is going to place his people in an extremely small country, but a very strategically placed one that will ultimately facilitate the spread of the message that he has for humanity and expedite its distribution and proclamation into all of the ancient world. And that's what God's goal here is. So as Abram comes on the scene, the Bible, of course, describes that he has these herds. And we know this specifically whenever Lot and Abram return from Egypt and there is the dispute that takes place among the herdsmen of grazing rights issues. And so Abram offers Lot, you know, you decide which way you're going to go and I'll go the other direction. Well, here is a photograph that I took a number of years ago in February down in generally the region of Beersheba, which is part of that arena within which Abram is going to be running around with his animals. And of course, you can see the sheep and the goats grazing on the fine vegetation that is just emerging. Give it another about 3 months and it's all going to be brown. All right, but at this juncture, it's just emerging. You can imagine the sheep and the goats are ecstatic, you know, all this nifty food that they're eating. If you look carefully, you can see the shepherd over here on the far right-hand side. And he's not dressed in any kind of traditional garb, but they're out there watching their animals and so forth. Now, we can infer that the sheep and goats that Abraham had were much more numerous than this. They may not have all been in one concentration, but nonetheless, this is the kind of scene in the general vicinity that would have characterized a lot of his travels. This is another scene near Beersheba, down in the region. This is the summertime. Notice the gray, the brown terrain that is there, the dried grass and everything else. And the trees, of course, become critical because in this part of the world, while it does get hot, it'll get down up to 100, 105 degrees fairly easily. But if you get in the shade because of the low humidity and the breezes blowing, it's amazing how relatively comfortable you can be. So I can easily imagine Abram setting up a tent underneath one of these trees. And the Bible does describe them that he lives in tents. I don't know that they necessarily look like this, but these are some of the tents that the Bedouin use. And the Bedouin enjoy living in the tents. I remember when I first went to Israel and Jordan and so forth back in the 70s and traveling along, particularly in Jordan, where there was much more tent living and so forth. And I looked at that and I said, these poor people living out here in these tents. And then I began really to look at what was going on. And almost every one of them had two or three Mercedes-Benz parked outside. And my pity for them went away. This is the way they choose to live. Now, that doesn't mean all of them are wealthy, don't get me wrong, but nonetheless, this is the mode of livelihood that they prefer. They want to be able to take up stakes, move to another location with their flocks and so forth. And of course, the Bible will describe Abram at his tent when the angels come and he's going to entertain them in the heat of the day. So it's a scene sort of like this when that event unfolds. Now, this is a photograph from a friend of mine, Farrell Jenkins, who lives up here in Temple Terrace, is it? Is that? Temple area, okay. And this is the general area of what Hebron region would look like. And imagine in this setting, oak trees, okay. The vegetation here is minimal now because of the deforestation of people overusing the resources. But the Israelis are trying to revamp all of this. But imagine in this oak trees and Abram out there with his tent, and here come the angels, and he begins then to take care of them, show hospitality toward them, and so forth. This is the kind of world in which Abram is living. It's rather rural, but again, he's flocks and herds, and you've got to take the flocks and herds where the food is. But one of the peculiarities that we often don't think about is how militarized all of this was. And that's what I want to focus on. And the next several slides are probably going to become a little tedious to you, okay? But it's the repetition that I want you to see of the dynamic of what is happening. Now remember, the distance from Dan to Beersheba is about 150 miles. The distance from the Dead Sea to the coast through Beersheba is about 75 miles. And the distance from the city of Dan in the north to the coast is about 25 miles. So it's, again, a very small country. So as Abram is going around herding his sheep and his goats, he will be able to see a lot of fortifications, a lot of cities that are very urbanized and militarized. This is, of course, the Bible will talk about Abram pursuing and trying to rescue his nephew Lot, who's been taken captive by the Mesopotamian kings, Genesis chapter 14. And it will talk about him going to Dan, and then he goes on up to Damascus, where finally he does retrieve his nephew. This is the remains of a mud brick city gate at Dan that may well have been there when Abram comes through the town and passes by. This would not be necessarily unique to what he might see, but this is the kind of thing that he would be familiar with. And you can see perhaps the archway that is filled in with debris here. But you can see the mud brick structure. And here is a drawing or a model of what ultimately that would have likely looked like. Now, there are two aspects to this. There's the mud brick gate that you have there and reconstructed here. And in the to the sides of it is what is known as a glacis. It's a tamped surface that is tamped hard and often coated with plaster. And these are intended to be defensive measures. Now, on a certain level, you may ask, well, why don't they just make tall walls? Well, the taller the wall is, you need something to sort of stabilize it. They hadn't quite gotten to some of the construction techniques that we're familiar with. And so they would stabilize the tall wall by building the slope up against it. And then they would make it slick, I put that in quotes, by plastering it. And if an enemy were to come, then they could pour water and olive oil on that and make it slick and make it really difficult to clamber up it. Plus, with the added slopes that are there, if the enemy tried to dig underneath the wall, they have to dig a whole lot further distance and would tend to curtail some of their determination. Now, look at how the thinking process is operating. And as we continue in the vicinity, the city of Ashkelon discovered a similar kind of fragment of a mud brick gate. Here is the opening. This is again debris that is there, but see the mud bricks that are there. And here is the slope, the glacis that is there. And while it looks like it's stepped, it is, that's the way it has been preserved, it was overlaid with the plaster and so forth, which over time has deteriorated. But you can get some idea of how high that is, even without a human scale in there. I mean, this is formidable. Here is the opening of the gateway, which is, by the way, just off to the left of the photograph of the glacis. And notice how thick that is. If you start to go through the gate into the interior of Ashkelon, you're looking at a distance of about from here to that wall in order to go from outside the city to the inside of the city. I mean, these are massive kind of fortifications constructions. This is the city, an aerial view of the city of Hazor, Hazor, as most of you would be familiar with it. This is the Solomonic town that Solomon fortified. This is the earlier period from the time roughly of the patriarchs. Now, this does not have the same kind of fortification system, but over here on the west side, you can't see it very well, so I have a photograph here where I want to try to accentuate this. They dug a dry moat that is about 30 feet deep, and they took the soil from that and piled it up over here, which raised it another 30 feet. So again, if the enemy's coming off from the west, they're going to have to run down into the moat and clamber up 60-foot elevation in order to get inside the city. And of course, if you're burdened down with weaponry and some armor and all of that kind of stuff, I mean, this is not going to be an easy task. And it gives the defenders an opportunity to help defend the city. Another town that has been excavated is the site of Gezer. This is the location where Dr. Woods excavated back in, I think, 1970, 71. Here's a drawing of some of the fortification system. And I want to show you the corner of this defensive tower. And to give you some idea of how big it is, that's me. I realize I'm not the best of scale. Okay, a lot of you are taller than I, but you can tell. Okay, that is not a little fortification part. And then, of course, it would be originally much, much taller. And then there's another element of, there's the gateway that is portrayed in the drawing there that you can go through. But it also has a glacis, and in the excavation, this is the debris piled on it. This is the constructed glacis and the plastered surface. And that's the angle at which that was made. It's about a 45-degree angle And again, think in terms of if an enemy comes, then they could pour a mixture of oil and water. And if you've ever mixed those together, it can make a pretty slick substance. And you pour it on there, and it's going to make it extremely difficult for anybody to climb up that. Or we can look at Jericho. This is part of the preserved Middle Bronze city wall of the city of Jericho from the time of the patriarchs, probably reused at a later point in the time of the period when the children of Israel come through. And again, it also has a glossy. Now, if you go to Jericho today, you rarely are able to see this, but I managed to convince the tour guide to let me out of the normal system and go take a picture of it. So here I, you know, the archaeologists do have occasional privileges. But this is the remnant of part of the glossy at Jericho. Here is the city gate from the site at Beth Shemesh. We excavated this back in about 2005 or so. And while it isn't particularly impressive, you can see there's a person there and there's a person there. And it's not as big and formidable as some of the others we're looking at, but there is the opening from the outside to the inside. The opening here in the passageway is about 4 meters wide. Excuse me, 4 yards. Okay, most of you aren't into meters. Sorry about that. And so it's about 4 yards wide. And these little indentations are to restrict the passage of an incoming enemy so that they're sort of bottled up should they make their way through and to help facilitate defending the site. This is a site, an aerial view of the site of Shechem. This is where Abram first goes and offers the sacrifice when he first arrives in the land of Canaan, according to the narrative in Genesis chapter 12. But what I want you to see here is what is known as a Migdal temple. The word Migdal means fortress. A very appropriate name. Now, on a certain level, and then talk about it being a temple, you may think, well, you know, it's just a sort of religious structure. Not necessarily. It was also a structure that oftentimes in time of siege, the citizenry would retreat into in order to find protection. This is exactly what happens in the book of Judges when Abimelech has become king and he besieges the city of Shechem and the citizenry retreats into the Migdal temple, which, by the way, that is it. I'll show you in a second. And he burns it down. Okay. That is the Migdal temple. Now, on a certain level, it doesn't look very big, but here again are some big vehicles. These are not little Japanese Hyundais and you know, those kind. I'm not knocking those, nothing wrong with those vehicles, but they typically are a lot smaller. These are like your American, you know, Impalas and stuff. All right. And look at how long that is. Look at how thick that wall is compared with that vehicle. Fortress fits. I mean, these walls are like 15 feet thick. And then you'd have the superstructure. Now, again, Larry Stager at Harvard argues that this is probably the structure that had lasted for a long period of time. This is probably the structure that Abimelech burned down in the book of Judges. But it had been there for centuries and finally came to its demise in the book of Judges. This is part of the fortification system. This is the city gate that you go in. Here's the part of the fortification system, and that's sort of how it looks now. By the way, that is the mountain of Gerizim in the background, to which the woman at the well alludes whenever she talks about our fathers worshipped in this mountain, but that's another whole discussion. Tantalizing you here, David. And at Megiddo, you have a similar kind of Migdal temple construction. If you look at the scale here, where's the scale? The scale's on here somewhere. Lost it. Oh, there it is. From there to there is 5 yards plus. And if you look at that and think in terms of the thickness of the walls that you have here, you're looking at 3 to 4 yards thick. I mean, that's massive kind of stuff. Now, the reason you have three of these is what happened over time is one of these temples was there. It was destroyed, but because of the aura of the religion and the sanctification of the site, they would then come along and build on top of it. And so you'd have a similar structure on top of it. And then when that one eventually is destroyed, the same kind of thing takes place, and they would build a third one on top of that. This is a very, very common strategy in the Middle East when it comes to religious structures. But again, all of them are Migdal temples. All of them are fortress temples. But you raise the question, why are they fortress temples? Well, there's a dual purpose. One is a place for the citizenry to retreat in under siege, but it also is a place to protect the wealth of the citizens and the temple. I mean, they don't want it just everybody breaking in and stealing the gold and silver and all that kind of stuff. So the resources that are there. And this, again, is an extremely common kind of characteristic of construction in the ancient biblical world and elsewhere for that matter. Now, back at Gezer, another peculiar aspect there, this is often referred to as the high place, but there are a series of pillars. There's one laying down. There's a pillar, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. There's a fragment of one there, nine and ten. The rest, the top parts are missing. And there were 10 of these lined up. And the assumption, the inference is that this was a representation of sort of a coalition of city-states that would come together from time to time to vow their allegiance to one another, that if one of you is attacked, then the rest of us will come to your defense. Think in terms of NATO or something like that. All right. And so that they would come together from time to time and they would reaffirm their allegiance to one another. Now, notice sort of the implication of this. Why are they thinking in terms of having to come together to defend one another if there isn't really a potential threat out there? And I'm not suggesting it's Abraham. Okay. I'm not at all suggesting the threat's Abraham. Abraham's not the threat. It's from other sources, either imagined or real. And we don't know for sure whether it's necessarily real, but we're going to develop that. Now, in Egypt, there was a document known as the Story of Sinai. And this is a story that apparently it has some historical roots to it. And the preservation here is documented, again, a photograph from Farrell Jenkins in this case. And a number of documents and copies of this thing have been found. And it's quite lengthy. This is only a part of a fragment of the story. But in the 19th and 20th centuries BC, this king was off on a campaign. The army was off on a campaign, and while the army was away from Egypt, in Libya in this case, the king died. And a new king came to the throne, and the general named Sinai sort of becomes concerned about his safety, and so he runs away to Canaan. And he's going to move to the country of Canaan, where he is hired by a local I'm going to use the word sheikh in the sense of a native individual who has a large entourage of people under his control. And he's hired by this sheikh who wants the Egyptian general to train his men in military arts in the land of Canaan. And if you read the story of Sinai, it's remarkable how it dovetails exactly with the issues that are described in the Bible. The land of Canaan is described as essentially a land of flowing with milk and honey kind of stuff, and you know, a lot of vegetation growing and productivity and all of that kind of thing. And it's exactly what the Bible describes the land of Canaan being and the children of Israel moving into. And so Sinai moves there and he's hired to do this sort of local training of the locals. And he becomes sort of the head individual in all of this. But eventually he becomes homesick. And he wants to go back to the land of Egypt, and he goes back to the land of Egypt, and so it's sort of the prodigal son kind of thing, and the Egyptians all welcome the general back home, and this now is preserved in these documents. But what I want you to catch is the military dynamic that is there. And this is roughly the same time period, slightly before perhaps, of the time when Abraham is going to come on the scene. Why does this sheikh, which, by the way, is not the term that would have been used, but why is this sheikh concerned about having trained military personnel in his household? Unless there is some real or imagined threat in the vicinity. Similarly, about the same time period, this is a tomb painting from Beni Hassan tomb in Egypt. And this is the Egyptians' portrayal of a bunch of Canaanites. Not Israelites, okay, a bunch of Canaanites. This is not a portrayal of Abraham. but a bunch of Canaanites that are coming down into the land of Egypt. The Egyptians are portrayed here. All of the rest of them are Canaanites. Now, the way this painting is on the wall, see the nose of the donkey? That ought to be back here. Okay, so they've split this in order to put it all sort of on a slide that's big enough for you to see. So that would be the front, and it would continue around and continue this direction. But what I want you to notice are several things. One is the colorful garments that the Canaanite people wear, as opposed to the white garments of the Egyptians. Secondly, the shoes and sandals that they have. I mean, you talk about, this is like Clark's, going to Clark's, you know, shoe store, right on fashion. Notice this is a bellows that the donkey is carrying. These are copper workers, metal workers, who are itinerant, moving about from place to place. But there's something else. The inscription up here, which I can't read. My hieroglyphics is a bit rusty. Well, it's non-existent. But anyway, reading from the scholars that have talked about this, it talks about the leader of the group, and they're bringing to sell coal. Now, this is not C-O-A-L, the stuff you burn. This is C-O-H-L, which has nothing to do with a department store. All right. This is the black paint that Egyptians would wear in around their eyes, and the kind of thing that football players will often wear, and so forth and so on. And there's a dual function here. One is it reduces the glare of the refractions off the sand. But secondly, it also helps keep the flies away from the eyes. And so there's a practical kind, I mean, several practical applications of this. And these itinerant individuals are coming in, selling coal and doing metalworking. But I also want you to notice the weaponry, all right? Bows, throwing sticks, spears. Here's a quiver. Here's a bow. This is, by the way, not a throwing stick. I'm going to come back and talk about it. There's a lyre that the individual has. There's a spear in the back of the donkey. And even the children sometimes are carrying spears. Now, one could argue that, well, they're defending themselves as they travel through the wilds of the Sinai Peninsula. Well, I can understand that, okay? But it's interesting that the Egyptians reflect all of this in their painting. They look at the Canaanites as being relatively well-armed people coming in. They're going to become concerned about the encroachment into the Egyptian world from the Canaanites, and guess what they do? Nothing's changed under the sun. They build a wall. Nothing different, you know. Nothing new under the sun. They build a wall to try to restrict the movements. Now, they're going to control the aspect, but nonetheless, they want to try to keep these Canaanites from coming in and invading the country. It's sort of within this kind of context that Abram is going to come to the land of Canaan. There's a famine, and he goes down to the land of Egypt. Of course, he gets in trouble there because he pawns his wife off as a sister, and all kinds of problems ensue. But nonetheless, eventually he's going to return to the land of Canaan. Now, another wrinkle in all of this has to do with diplomacy into the Canaanite world as well as trade aspects. There are two aspects that we have here. One, I want you to look at the geography again. From Babylon to Mari, Babylon is over here, to Mari, which is there, is about 250 miles. From Mari to Hazor, which is over here, is about 300 miles. Now, they didn't travel like you and I do. You know, I talked with a number of folks this morning that were here. Perhaps some of you have traveled, you know, several hours to get here. Not quite those distances, perhaps, but nonetheless, they didn't drive vehicles. They rode donkeys, they walked, and so forth. So on a maximum sustained travel basis, one cannot reasonably expect to go over 20 miles a day. Now, there are perhaps exceptions in the ancient world, Persians, for instance, in their messaging system. But for all practical purposes, 20 miles a day on a sustained level is about all one could accomplish. And so we're looking at a 27-day trip from Babylon to Hazor. That's a month to make a trip. And yet there are diplomats from Babylon over here that are resident in Hazor during this time period. Time of the patriarchs. So the people in Babylon must have been impressed with something about Hazor over here, in order to have resident diplomats to correspond with them back and forth. But there's also the tin trade. Tin is vital to a technological development. A lot of the weapons in the earlier period, known as the early Bronze Age, there is no bronze in the early Bronze Age. It's a misnomer, all right? And they had copper weapons. Copper, if you've ever done anything with copper, it bends fairly easily. Some contaminated copper can be a little more substantive, but it's not really very good. They had copper saws. I can only imagine how frustrating that would be, you know, to cut a stone with a copper saw, and then you got to sharpen it. How, you know, four stripes, got to sharpen it again, kind of thing, you know, over and over and over. But when some bright person comes along and says, you know, if we put some tin in the copper, it makes it much more hard and durable, and it yields bronze. And they discover tin mines over in what we would now call Afghanistan. Again, huge long-distance trading connections. And so tin is shipped into this region, and there is a load of tin that goes to Dan that is about 10 pounds of tin. Now, depending on the amount of tin mixed with the copper, which usually ranges someone from 5% to 10%, that would yield anywhere from 100 pounds to 200 pounds of bronze. And bronze arrowheads aren't very heavy. And bronze arrowheads start to come on the scene at this point. Another technological advance that occurs. Now, the amount of tin that arrives at Hazor is 77 pounds of tin, which would yield 700 plus pounds at minimum of bronze, or if it's a 5% mixture, up to 1,500 pounds, 3/4 of a ton. You can make a lot of weapons with that amount of bronze. And there was this technological development that occurs just on the cusp of the what we would call the 2000 into the 1900s BC era. Now, it didn't happen overnight, okay, but you have this kind of development that begins to take place. And Abram is in the flux of this. And here are some of the, this is the distance that we're talking about and the route that would be under consideration. And among those weapons, this is a copper axe head from the ancient world. And they developed these others that we often refer to technically as fenestrated axes, but affectionately refer to them as duck-billed axes. Can you figure out why? The archaeologists aren't very creative either. These are not very big. These are axes. The duck-billed axe heads are about this long, and they're about that wide. And they are not intended to chop down trees. They are intended to kill people. They're basically sort of tomahawk kind of things. But these are made out of bronze, and they're rather hefty. We have one in the museum at Harding that if you're ever there, if it's not on display in the museum, find me and I can show you, because actually it's mine. But anyway. But it's rather hefty and weighty, and I would not want to get hit with it anywhere on my body, much less my head. And it would do a number on a head should one get hit with it. But they begin to develop this sophistication. Now, interestingly, back in that Beni Hassan painting, the dude at the end of it is carrying one of these fenestrated axes. And, I mean, it's just a fascinating kind of setting. Now, there is a development that takes place. The difficulty of making fenestrated axe heads was challenging because of the lost wax development process. So they began to develop these chisel axes. This is a chisel axe. The handle would go through here, and that notch would be where they would sort of tighten it up to the handle and so forth. And the chisel axe is about this long and about that wide. And again, it is designed not to cut down trees, not to do anything, but merely to kill. This is the kind of world in which Abram is emerging. By the way, the item in the background was a stone mold that was discovered at Shechem, where they would pour the metal and then finish the product. Now, the dots on the map here. Now, remember, from Dan up here to Beersheba there is 150 miles as a crow flies. These are some of the sites where we have identified Middle Bronze Age fortification systems. So as you think in terms of Abram running around down here, he has to be able to see these. City set on a hill cannot be hidden. Okay, most of these towns are up on hills and elevations. And so as he's wandering around with his sheep and his goats, there's a fortification system, there's a fortification system, there's a fortification, over here's a fortification. And Abram is running around with his sheep and goats, taking them different places. He has occasional encounters, not in a hostile way, although the well-digging issue is a problem. But nonetheless, Melchizedek's relationship is reasonably good. And even eventually, the one with Abimelech over there is reasonably good. But nonetheless, this is the kind of world in which Abram is familiar. Now, the Egyptians felt threatened by all of this. And again, think in terms of the dovetail with the story of Sinai that we talked about. In Egypt, they were concerned about the development of this fortification system, these city-states in the land of Canaan, and they produced what are known as execration texts. Here are two examples of these. The one on the left-hand side is in the museum at Eretz Israel Museum in Tel Aviv. The other one is in Belgium. And what these are these figures made in the shape of dolls, and they would write the inscription on it. And the inscriptions say things like, "Cursed be the king of Akshaf, and cursed be the king of Megiddo, and cursed be the king of Lachish, and cursed be the king of Shechem," and on and on and on. And then they would write all of this on it and break the doll as sort of a voodoo effect. Okay, so breaking the doll sort of puts the curse in motion. Now, there are two different kinds of curse texts that the Egyptians had. First ones were these figures, and then they later had versions of bowls where they would have the similar kind of declarations in it, and they'd break the bowl. But the same kind of dynamic. But the Egyptians apparently looked at what was going on in the land of Canaan as either imagined or real threats. Now, the reason I phrase it that way is the academic world seems to have trouble with looking at sort of the normalcy of stupidity of people. And the argument is, well, you know, there wasn't really anything in the land of Canaan that was threatening. Well, look at all the fortifications, you dipsticks. Sorry. And, they have some reason to be concerned about this. Now, whether there was a reality of an invasion or not is another issue. But nonetheless, the Egyptians seem to be concerned about what is transpiring and unfolding here in the land of Canaan. This is the world in which Abram lives. Now, look at this one. This is early on in his arrival when he goes to rescue Lot. The photograph, by the way, is from Lawrence of Arabia. But nonetheless, it portrays, you know, the sort of kind of thing that, I mean, there are no vehicles in there except the camels and all that. But you can imagine some entourage like this. But the scripture says when Abram heard that his kinsman had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men. His trained men born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. Why does he have a military? Apparently there was a real threat. Now, interestingly, the only occasion when the Bible gives any indication that he does this is when he goes to rescue Lot. There is no evidence whatsoever anywhere in Scripture that Abram does anything with this military entourage at his disposal to take over the country. None. And I find that to be striking. The only property that Abram ever owns is the tomb. Well, the wells that were dug, which are disputed, and then the tomb that he buys in which to bury his wife and into which he himself eventually will be buried. We don't really know what this looks like. There was Yigal Yadin, Israeli general back in the 67 war, rather cavalier kind of dude, went to the tomb there in Hebron and sent a young individual down in there to look around, but there are no photographs that I know of. This is actually a recreation where they found a Middle Bronze Age tomb at Jericho, roughly the time period of the patriarchs, and they have set it up in the Rockefeller Museum in East Jerusalem. And so this is a photograph of a Middle Bronze Age, sort of typical wealthy individual's tomb in a cave. Now, whether Abram is buried like this exactly or not, I don't know. But it's reasonable that he probably was, okay? So what we have here is a platform in the middle where the deceased is placed and left then the body to deteriorate. But if you look carefully, you might see around the perimeter there are other skulls. There are skulls scattered around where the individual has sort of been shoveled off of the platform with the new individual being placed there. And it's interesting that the phraseology in the Bible is being gathered to one's fathers to describe burial procedures. And of course, the tomb in which Abram, you know, Sarai is going to be buried is going to be his repository, that of Rachel and not Rachel, of Leah and Jacob and Isaac. And, you know, the family is going to be there. Plus, there would be probably other individuals. This is the only property that Abram ever owns, other than the wells that are off toward the coastal plain. In spite of having all that 318 men trained in his household in military arts. Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation. And I will bless you and make your name great, and so you shall be a blessing. And those who bless you, I will bless. Those who curse you, I will curse. And in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And Abram had enough faith that when he goes, no indication of a militarism on his part to take it over. I often wonder, once I became familiar with all of this, what did Abram think when he got there? You're going to give me all of this? How? When? But he has the faith that God is going to do what God promised. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. And by faith, he went to live in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city that has foundations, whose designer and builder is God. I have to admit that the more I learned about the Middle Bronze Age, the more impressed I was with the faith of Abraham. Now, admittedly, there are occasions in his life when he's challenging God, wondering what's going on, but he stuck with it. And isn't that sometimes the challenge that we have? Our God is a mighty God. We occasionally sing that. Well, he certainly is. But this mighty God that Abram served, who is the, in a sense, don't misinterpret this, what I'm saying, but in a sense, he's the father of God's people. I know God is the father, okay, but don't misunderstand me. But it's through Abram that God is beginning to unfold this strategy. And he become, I mean, even Paul will talk in terms about the grandeur of the character of Abram. And he had the faith to follow even though he did not understand what all was going on. And that is trust. That's the kind of trust that God wants of us. We don't know what the future holds or how it unfolds. We know ultimately what the future holds. But the meandering path from here to there, are we willing to put our lives in his care? The redemption that this mighty God has offered to us is profound. It is a land greater than that was promised initially to Abram. We're still looking for the city whose builder and maker is God. Are you willing to get on that journey with him and all the other faithful ones? Believing that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, sent into the world to be the redemption and the Lamb of God to take away sin. Repenting of your sin, turning away from a life of sin and pledging allegiance to the Lord. Confessing Jesus as the Son of God and being baptized by immersion to have your sins washed away and raised to walk a new life in hope of an eternity in heaven, as well as an enriched life here. If you're subject of that invitation, we invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.